Hello and welcome to Conversations from the Adoption and Fostering podcast. In this episode, I speak to adoptive single parent Matthew. He shares his experience of applying to adopt as a single man and the unique challenges that that brought. As always, if you've experienced of adoption, fostering or special guardianship from any perspective and would like to share that on the podcast, please get in touch through the Facebook or Twitter page, or you can email us at aandfpodcast@gmail.com.
My name is Matthew Munson. I'm a writer and a communications officer for a children's charity. And I'm also a dad, most importantly of all, an adoptive dad, if to be precise. I'm a single adopted dad to a 10-year-old boy who is brilliant. But of course, he would say that, and so would I guess. I never wanted children during my 20s. I'm 40 now. In my 20s, that was it. Yeah, don't want kids. Nope, not interested. And then got to 2014, and I did. I don't know quite why or how, but I did. I was single then, as I'm single now, and I had a choice really to make, or a sort of path to think about. Did I want to start thinking about relationships with becoming a parent that way in my head? But I didn't want to start a relationship just to have a child. You know, if I'm going to have a relationship, it's going to be for relationship's sake. And then if a child became part of that, great. But at that point I was, 34, 35, and I didn't know, you know, I wanted it to happen naturally if it was going to happen. So, you know, how long do you wait? They come to the point where you have to think, I want to start this process now. So 2014 was it for me, I think. And I just kind of thought, no, now is the time. And I need to be brave. And if I want to be a dad and I'm not in a relationship, then I need to do something about that. And it was a bit scary in a way, because I had to make that kind of big leap and think, well, there's nobody here standing next to me to co-parent. You know, I'm not even in a separated relationship where a child goes between two homes. It's just me. So I contacted, I looked at the local authority. I live down in the southeast, and I looked at our local authority, but they weren't taking on new adoptive or prospective adopters at the time, because they were oversubscribed and they hadn't got enough staff. It's probably quite a familiar refrain for local authorities, I think, after a while. So I went with I went with Barnardo's. I don't know whether that's called a regional or a voluntary. I don't know the difference, to be honest. And I met with a social worker, started the assessment process. You know, made it all sound very easy. It was going through, and then I lost my job. Oh, my job came to an end, rather. The contract that I was working on came to an end. What the job I thought was going to be coming up didn't come up. So all these plans I had to suddenly become a dad stopped for about 18 months. Had to move back in with my sainted parents for a while whilst you looked for another job, was looking for a new home, etc., because money situation was tight. And then picked it up again because I started working. Was working for this for a children's organisation, and then I kind of started again. Got a different social worker with Barnardo's, and I had to go through that PAR, the prospective adoption support, again from scratch. And As somebody who has worked with social workers but isn't a social worker myself, I'm a communications officer, I'm a writer, that's my bag. I found myself, I connected with that social worker. You know, I'm speaking to a social worker now, so you know, if you get that connection, it's brilliant. And I found that she got me in a kind of a weird way that was just fantastic, because she was going, well, why did you do that? Well, what about that in your past? And what about this? And how does that work? And well, why did you say that? Not in a negatively challenging way, but in a professional way, you know, to try and tease out my style. And in a way, and I think in a way that that did help me become a better parent. And I'm not just saying that on the off chance she ever hears this, or because I'm pandering to a social worker that I'm speaking to now. It genuinely made me a better parent, because it made me think, why do I do that? You know, how was I parented as a child myself? What do I want to take from that? Well, how do I deal with my friends' kids, and what's good about that? And actually, maybe what could I do a bit better? And it was really powerful. And she and I did discuss, there was this thing about, you know, I was a single male adopter who was, what, 37 at the time. And, you know, that was comparatively unusual.
Yeah.
I guess. There are, of course, there were single parents, single male parents, but sometimes that's because a relationship is broken up. You know, there were no other in the support groups that I went on. The 3-day course that you go on. I can remember that almost everyone there was talking to me going, oh, why? Really? You can almost see kind of, a couple of them kind of almost in their eyes, there was this sense of, oh, you poor thing. Oh, you haven't got a partner. Yeah. Well, I'm not becoming a dad because I'm looking for a partner. I'm looking to become a dad so I can parent a child. It's two different things. If I go into this to look for a partner, I need help of a different kind. That's not what it's for.
Yeah.
And there was this confusion, I think, from people of kind of, you know, you're a bloke, you haven't got a, be it gay or straight or whatever, you're not what? So that was kind of funny in a way. It hadn't occurred to me till then that people might think that, you know, until my social work, I had to sort of have a couple of discussions. I went back to afterwards and I went, some of these people were talking about this and seemed surprised that I was doing it by myself. Is that right? Is it surprising? She went, well, it's not common. I thought, okay, all right, I've got that now. Fair enough. And then...
Was there a sense of... did you encounter any suspicion from any parties? Because I think that's prejudice, maybe.
I think... Not from Bernardo's, absolutely not. No way. Yeah. There was nothing. So I think the only time it really happened, maybe subtly, maybe it wasn't even, there was something, was when I got matched to my boy, to Brian, and we were starting the planning process to go towards introductions. It slowed down far, far slower than you would kind of expect for an average adult. Match process. What's average? But if for everything, because from one of the managers, particularly from the local authority, there was a sense of, we just need to make sure that Matthew's okay. It's a high risk placement, I think was the term that was used, and the trying to get to the bottom of what high risk actually meant to them.
Right.
I never did. I never actually understood. Was it high risk because I'm the sole wage earner in the household? Yep. Is it because you're worried about my emotional state? Is it because I'm male and you want to check on my intentions? I never got a straight answer to that to that question. Maybe they didn't know. I don't know. I'm trying to be fair, although at the time I wasn't interested in being fair. I was a bit cross at the time, I think.
That's only reasonable.
Yeah. It took longer. You know, the panel date was meant to be in January and we finally got a panel date in March because they wanted to get a couple more assessments done of me and Brian and wanted to make sure that all was okay and everything was going through. And they wanted to get this part of their... adoption process involved after the adoption went through. That didn't happen. I've not heard from them at all since. So whatever this plan was for additional support didn't happen. It didn't occur to me till about a year later. So I thought, I never actually heard back from them. So, you know, it obviously wasn't as high priority to them as maybe they originally thought it was going to be. So it was odd from that point of view. And I think when I heard that they were going to put back the second panel date, the matching panel date, because they wanted to understand more about me and wanted to sort of make sure that match was going to be perfect because it was just me, that I found frustrating. You know, for a brief moment, I thought, well, what's wrong with me? You know, I've gone through this process. I've been assessed by professionals. You know, I'm I've been accepted by my son's social worker to be appropriate and acceptable. I know I've got to go through panel to make sure panel are happy with it, and for the ADM, I accept all that. That's fine. What else do you need from me? I'm an open book. Everything about me is in my par. I'll answer any of your questions. Just talk to me. So that felt a frustration, and I think listening to myself now, I think even now I perhaps carry some of that frustration with me that I don't even realise, because I don't even think about it now. That was frustrating. But we finally got there, and I think for so Brian was set. This was when he was still seven. He came home when 4 days after he turned eight, and so his foster carers, who were fantastic with him and his siblings, had to really think about the messages they gave him about single parents versus two parent families. Because he was, at that point, he was in a two parent foster family. And before that, when he lived with his birth family, there were two adults there. So for him, he'd never experienced a single parent who was new, but especially who was new to parenting. You know, I'd never parented before. I say I knew other children. I'd cared for other children, but just, my friends, I'd stayed for sleepovers. I'd babysat and stuff like that. That's different to having a child full time, of course. So they did a lot of work, and actually the foster mum in particular, she knew him inside out. You know, she really got him in the 2 years that she fostered him. And so she gave me a lot of tips. Like, look, come on, this is how he is. This is the sort of person he is. You know, think about this. This is what he needs from you as his dad. So that helped me think, okay, my parenting style needs to be like that.
Yeah.
You know, which kind of aligned with my natural personality anyway, kind of fairly straightforward, fairly open and honest, therapeutic and caring and empathetic and all the rest of it. But it was useful to have her input on that. And even now, actually, when a couple of times when it's funny, a couple of people who don't know, maybe people who meet us more recently, who don't know that Brian's adopted, just because we've not mentioned it to them, because we hide it, and they said, is it just you and your dad, Brian, or is mum at home or whatever? And he always says, I haven't got a mum. I sort of go, okay, we kind of need to talk about that a little bit. And so a couple of times I thought, it's fine. He's 10, so I'm not patronising him at all. You know, I believe in you know, let's say things how they are in terms of, you know, reproduction and age appropriate, obviously, but still. I was saying, Brian, you do know kind of that process. How did you come into the world? I was born, Daddy, like most kids, all kids. Okay, to a woman, who was your birth mother? Oh yeah, but I haven't got a mum anymore. Okay, something to work on. That's an ongoing process. Yeah. He's right. You know, I'm the single parent. I have sole legal rights, parental rights, everything like that. It's just me. But there's still that kind of connection there, isn't there? There's still that kind of history there. So we have to kind of think about that and have those conversations, because he's very comfortable saying, oh, yeah, I've got a dad. I've just got a dad. That's my dad over there. You know, that's him. Oh, no, I haven't got a mum. No, it's just me and my dad. That's it. That's why my brother and sister live with their mum and dad down further down the coast. Oh, yeah, that's all fine. Yeah, it's all good. And it's at the moment, it seems to him very normal. So I can't speak to the future in that sense, but so at the moment it's become normalised that there's three children in two different households and there's three adults. So an adult per child, as he looks at it.
Yeah.
And he likes the attention of being the solo child now. He's adjusted to it, to a single parent. He gets all my attention. Obviously probably too much sometimes, because it's just him and I and in the house. And he kind of feeds off that, I think, a little bit. You know, he's a showman and that really works for him.
Could I ask you You said something and it made me think about, often I hear people who are going through the process of adoption, and one of the requirements is that they sort of demonstrate their ability to look after children, which often, you know, people talk about the frustrations of like, well, where do you go and how do you do that? And who, you know, and that's difficult maybe as a couple and as a female. But I was thinking, is that then perhaps even more complicated? Where are the opportunities for adult males to look after children?
I have had this conversation actually with my social worker, because absolutely, yeah, you're right. I like all adopted, I had to demonstrate that I'd got, you know, experience of being and supporting children, not just a passing hi, but a deep, meaningful connection with children in a safe way. I can remember for a while looking into work, sort of doing some voluntary work for a local children's centre back in the days when children's centres were sort of slightly better funded and in bigger supply than they are now. It's not turning into part of a political broadcast, I promise. But yeah, there were more around.
That's your day job.
That's my day job. Yeah. back in those days. And so I did look into it, and I even sort of went through the DBS process. But I can remember meeting the children's centre manager, who was very pleasant to me, very polite. But you could see the conversation was going on for quite a while between her and I, because she was really trying to get into understanding, what, really? Why do you want to do this? And I was very open about it. I said, look, I'm not just doing it because I'm just fancy helping out. I have got an ulterior motive. This is what I want to do with my family life and how I want to progress it forward. And she went, really? You want to do that by yourself? And she, well, there was nothing to it. There was no malice behind it or anything like that. She was just surprised. And it kind of didn't go anywhere in the end, because probably from both of us, I kind of thought, well, I sort of felt a bit awkward after a while, because I was like, well, I don't know what else to say. I want to be a dad and I want to get some more experience. I'd like to do it here, please, because seems like a really nice place. You seem maybe a bit confused. Maybe she was, but maybe she could have got over it if I'd have vocalised a bit more, if I'd spent some time there. It kind of just petered out, to be honest. Now, I was very fortunate that a couple of friends of mine had two children who they'd, funnily enough, adopted a few years before, so they'd been through that process as well. So I'd seen it from the outside of their relationship and as they went through it with their kids, and I very fond of their kids, very close to them. So I looked after them quite a bit. I helped out where I could. So I think we kind of used that as my experience. But nothing prepares you for that moment where, for me, my son appeared at about 4:30 on a Saturday afternoon after they'd been travelling for like 6 or 7 hours down the country to get to me with his foster parents. And, you know, so they go and you've got these suitcases and this little kid staring at you in the hallway of your home, and you think, all right, this is it then. Okay.
Yeah.
You just feel this sense of, I don't quite know what to do, despite all the training, despite the brilliant and genuinely brilliant support I'd had. I thought, right, okay, what should I do? Okay, it's 4:30. Right, let's feed him. Let's get some dinner down him, and then we'll see what happens. Okay, he looks tired. I think we should probably put him to bed now. Okay, right. Okay, I think that's about right. And I was just like, right, okay. And then I remember he went to bed, and thankfully he fell asleep. And I rang my mum, and I just went, what's next? Wait for him to wake up. Okay. Do you know what I mean? And it was the same time, but it was just, I had no grand strategic plan for it. I was just like, well, what do I do now? And it was just, okay, right, today's Saturday, tomorrow's Sunday. I'm on adoption leave now for 8 months. Okay, let's just get this done. Brian had 2 weeks off he had a month off from school because it was around the Easter holiday time. So he came down in the last 2 weeks of the Easter term, had 2 weeks holiday, and then he started his new school. And I guess I look back and I think actually he had the bigger change, because, you know, he travelled quite a distance.
Yeah.
He didn't know anybody in the area apart from me, who he'd met a couple of dozen times maybe over the course of the last 3 months with the instructions, etc. you know, it was this big change for him. He didn't even have two parents or two caregivers anymore. He had one. And I think that was a kind of a big change for him. And I think, you know, there's always that stage at the start where the social workers always say, right, you know, first few weeks, just you and him, nobody else, just keep it small, keep it simple. And I did, but because it was just him and I think very quickly I felt that there was perhaps a need for him to start putting down roots with his other close, what would hopefully become his close support network in terms of family and people that he'd know for a long term. So probably a little bit sooner than maybe was recommended, not day two or anything, but, you know, within the first few weeks, we sort of bumped into his grandparents, my parents, bumped into a couple of good friends, and walked past his school a few times. Actually managed to arrange that he went into school for a couple of short sessions just to meet some of his friends at school who would become his friends.
Yeah.
So I think actually, I think that was right. I think that was the right thing for me to do. Looking back, of course, I would say that because I did it, but he was looking to put down roots. I could see in his eyes that he needed that stability that I could give him, but he needed more than just me. You know, he needed that community, that village to raise a child. And I think he was looking for that. You know, he spent two years in foster care that he knew wouldn't be forever. He was looking for roots. And I just found myself thinking, well, what would I want if I was a kid? I'd want those roots. I want to meet the people who are going to become those roots. So
I think it's really interesting because you've articulated really well this sort of the sense of everyone's busy, 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 and then one day there's a little boy in your house with a suitcase. It was interesting. I was chatting to a couple I know that have just adopted, and they express exactly the same in relation to this idea of isolation. And they sort of, I said, "Oh, so how did the isolation go?" And they sort of pulled slightly awkward faces and went, "Well, it wasn't as isolated as perhaps people had wanted, and it worked out okay."
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think I completely agree with that. You know, that principle of it should just be you and your child, nobody else for that time. It didn't quite work for us. It just, I could see what he was looking for because I was looking for it as well. You know, I mean, as we record this, I've been a dad for 2 years, 9 months. I'm still looking for it. I'm still looking for my tribe as well as, you know, as well as he is. We're still continuing to look and grow it, I guess. And I think as a single parent, I needed to make sure that I was grounded and that he was grounded in his community. You know, and so I look back and literally almost a year to the day that he came home, lockdown one started here in England. And so then I had that first year with kind of all the firsts, you know, first Easter at home, first summer holidays at home, first Christmas at home. We got over all those hurdles, if you want to look at it like that we'd got through all that, the anxieties that come with it, the breaking up of routines and the change of routines and going back to routines. We got through all of those things. And then literally almost to the nose on that first year anniversary, we went into lockdown and suddenly all that carefully crafted routine went out the window. Because
built, just a bit of stability.
And I followed the advice from people who knew better than me, like from social workers and other parents. You know, I built that first Christmas as a magical Christmas. I built, you know, some holidays and Easters, and we got childcare in place. So he knew for that second year, looking forward, what to expect. He knew what some holidays would look like. He knew what Christmas would look like. And now suddenly he didn't again, because it was something. And this time I didn't have the answers. Whereas in year one, I did, because I knew kind of with a vague sense of hopefully planning, I knew what it would look like. But now I suddenly didn't. And I was anxious and worried as much as he was anxious and worried, probably not quite as much because he was nine. And so suddenly we had to go through it all again. And kind of now we're in this kind of third year of, we kind of haven't really had any for a while, and let's hope it stays that way. that actually he's now remembering that first year that he was down when he was 8 going into 9. And suddenly he now thinks, the other day he was saying to me, oh, I remember this, Daddy, from my first year, from the first time we did this and did that. And, you know, he does pick up those things. And hopefully now that kind of intervening year can hopefully be consigned to the dustbin slightly. And now we get back into the familiar and the routine a little bit more. I don't know. It's a complicated one, but it made me appreciate how important support is for him and me, you know, that we didn't have it for so long. And especially during anxiety, providing parts in your life, like a lockdown, like a child standing in the hallway of a home that he doesn't know, looking at you going, oh, you're my parent. Are you my dad? Are you? All right. What do we do now? I'm thinking, I don't know. What's next? But I have to mask that because he needs me to be confident and go, yeah, I know what to do. I know what's going on. It's fine. Mm-hmm. I'm under control. And inwardly, I'm sobbing a little bit because I genuinely don't know. I kind of look back and I think, how would I have felt if that was me? I'd have been far more a little
overwhelming.
I think I would not have reacted as well to it all as he did. You know, he was far more willing to accept it than I think I would have been 30 odd years ago, which perhaps shows his resilience, I guess, in a way.
So thinking about 2014, when you first sort of set out on the journey to become a parent, how does this compare? I mean, obviously we've got COVID, no one knew, but how does parenting compare to what you thought it would be?
100 times better. And in the first year, 100 times more scarier than I could have imagined it would be. Because you don't fully know what it's going to be like when you start out on that journey. You know, your life does change totally and utterly. Everything about your life changes. Not in a bad way. I'm just saying it's the truth. It does. You have to change your routines willingly, because otherwise you'll start resenting the new life that you've got. I think in my head, I'd got an image of what I thought it was going to look like, because I say I'd got friends who were parents already, either kind of through biology or through adoption or whatever way it happened. So I'd seen it wasn't alien to me. I knew that how it happened and how it all works to a degree, but living it is very different to seeing it, of course. And that was really powerful for me. I have to remind myself that I've only been a parent for two years, 9 months, you know, and Brian's been a child for 10 years. So I am not his first parent. I will be his last. Unless I think catastrophically goes on with me, I will be his last. So it's for me to set the tone going forward, but also kind of accepting where he's come from. And it took me, I think that took me a little while to figure out that, okay, he's got these experiences in his past. He's got these, he had foster carers and then a birth family before that. And obviously he's experienced 3 lots of parenting, I guess, although me and his foster carers are quite similar. And I think from that point of view, I have to kind of think, well, how would I feel about that? You know, when I spent my first few years being parented in this way and then meeting foster carers, oh, but you're not staying with us. Mm. This unknown person is who you're going to be staying with. And then actually me, who was learning when he first came home, I think I have to understand that from him, that occasionally I think I'm not always inconsistent, but as I grow and as I learn as a parent, things I might say yes to now or no to that I might have said differently 2-3 years ago, or even 4 or 5 years ago before I was a parent. Or no, when I'm a parent, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to say it in this way, or I'm going to be totally therapeutic and totally even tempered all the time. My voice is never going to go above this calming voice, and it doesn't. And you lose your temper sometimes, and you're in tears sometimes, and you find yourself apologizing because you made your son cry because of something you said in the heat of a moment and you shouldn't have done it. And you know, the reality bites in yeah. a very quite powerful way when you're doing it. And yeah, I think it's going to be idealized when you first start out on yeah. that, because you think, this is what I want for my child, this is what I want for my son or my daughter or however many I have. This is how I'm going to do it. This is how I'm going to manage contact with his siblings, with their parents. This is what we're going to do. And then you think, okay, my son is a human being and he has a say in this as well. You know, yeah. He needs me to parent. He needs me to be strong, confident and lead, but he also needs to be heard and listened to and respected. And I think that was a side, I think, for me, that made me a lot more reflective when I started hearing what he had to say, as well as actually just saying to him, you need to listen to me. This is such a cliche. It's such a cliche when I say this, but he has taught me so much, you know. And I know that I am speaking in cliches as I say it. I do recognize that, but it is true. You know, he has taught me so much. I'm not a perfect parent, but he has made me a better parent as a result. He doesn't mind that he's adopted. There's nothing, you know, there's no shame in it. It's part of his life and it's normal to him. He doesn't like talking about it. He doesn't want to kind of really think about his past. He doesn't want to kind of integrate that and kind of understand that at the moment. It's like, no, you're my dad. These are my friends. These are my grandparents. There's my siblings over there. They're with their parents over there. I've got that. This is my life. I'm looking this way forward now. Don't want to look back. You know, it's a 10-year-old boy. That's where he is in his head, emotionally and intellectually at the moment.
Yeah.
And I have to kind of, I'm following him a little bit with that at the moment. So,
yeah.
Whereas I think in the past, I think I might have gone, no, Brian, okay, this is according to these studies, this is what I should be doing with you to help you understand your past. But actually I've gone, well, do you know what? You're not ready for it yet. You don't want to talk about it. Okay. Do you know what? Just for the moment, we'll just focus on the here and now. and we'll worry about tomorrow. I think a little bit with that. I don't think I'm storing up problems for later, but I'll come back on in a year's time and tell you if I am or that's not.
I mean, that is probably my last question, really, is what does the future hold for you?
Good question. So from that point of view, Brian goes to secondary school in September of this year. That's the biggest change, I guess, coming up, and also kind of the increased independence that comes with that, you know, and me having to back off a little bit from standing physically by his side as he walks to school every day or walks into the school gates, and exploring what freedom means to him and exploring what independence means to him and reliability and trust and all those things. So I guess we've kind of come through the first 3 years of getting to know each other, getting a routine going, and now it's helping him fly a little bit, I think, in a way. And I've got to learn how to do that as well. I've got to teach myself how to do that effectively, I think.
Because that's interesting you say that, because I reflect often that people who parent older children through adoption, often they're, you know, their experience of parenting, of child parenting children, is reduced significantly because of just the natural time. You know, I was saying before, my daughter was yes. six, and you felt like, oh my goodness, now she's 16. It was like, click your fingers. And
yeah. Yes, you're absolutely right. I struggled a bit. I first met Brian when he was with his foster carers when he was seven. And he came home 4 days after his eighth birthday, and now he's 10. He's going to be 11 in 2 months, and in 9 months he's going to secondary school. What the hell? What is going on? You know, I feel like we've packed quite a lot into the last 2 years. You know, he's embraced me in a wonderful way. I've embraced him, and yeah, I would love to have known him earlier. I would have done. You know, I'd be lying if I said I didn't. You know, I would love to have had him from birth. Of course I would. I'd be an absolute liar if I said that wasn't true. I do sometimes feel sad that I haven't got longer. Excuse me. Well, of those childhood years with him, because I would like to have seen more of that. I try and mitigate that with I'm excited for the teenage years that are coming ahead, I guess. I'm nervous about the teenage years, of course, but I'm excited about them as well. And I try and keep hold of the excitement more than the slight sense of sadness I've got that I didn't have longer of that sense of wonder that children have.
Yeah.
Doesn't always work. I'm human, like everyone else. I'm great at saying these things. It doesn't always work.
Yeah. No, I think it's reasonable, isn't it, that we have all of this stuff going on. There's no blame apportioned to our children at all. It's just the nature of the nature of this model of parenting is that there's gaps.
Brian is who he is. He is my son, and it, you know, it really surprised me. I think I wasn't sure how quick that kind of that bond between us would form. You know, the love. You know, when does love? I do apologize. When does love become something that is felt rather than just a thing you say just to kind of, you know, bring you closer together? It really surprised me how quick that happened. You know, that genuine love, and I've got nothing to compare it to because I don't have birth children. I've only been a parent once. But I genuinely feel that the love I have for him is as deep as if he'd been my birth son. That I don't see, there's no difference. It's I love my son, and that's, I'm not ashamed to say it. And that's where I am with it. I'm proud to be a dad. I'm proud to be an adopt. I'm a dad. You know, yes, I came to it by adoption. It's his story. Is his story. He'll come up against it as he grows up, as he becomes an adult himself. If he becomes a parent himself, he will come up against those memories of his past. Of course he will. That's inevitable. He's just this brilliant human being, and it is fascinating to watch a child grow and develop, you know, and yeah, I could go on about that all day, but yeah, it is fascinating watching this 10-year-old child become on the cusp of something that is bigger than just him, and he doesn't realise it yet. He doesn't realise this journey that he's got before him. None of us do when we're 10 years old, you know. And he does have, I hope, opportunities because of the adoption side. Like, for instance, here where we live, there's one of the rules that we've got when we go to secondary school is that children who are currently in care or have been in care in the past get first priority on any secondary school they choose to go to, which is great, which is fantastic. So we can be pretty, I don't want to say absolutely confident, we can be pretty confident that the first choice of school that we put down for him will be the school that he gets to go to. And it's wonderfully therapeutic. It's pastoral. It's got a brilliant education philosophy. It's absolutely right for his personality. And it's great that we can say, do you know what? That's a school we can pretty much be sure he's going to go to. That's a privilege. That's a privilege that we can acknowledge his adoptive status and his history, and in that sense, put it to a good use. Because it supports his personal development and his academic development. And he gets more help than just me, which is what he needs. So, yeah, sorry, I whisked on for ages on that one, but I agree with you completely. Yeah.
Matthew, thank you so much for your time, and really appreciate you sort of sharing your story and your son's story, and I wish you well in the future.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.